It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Our top story is the Trump administration tightening enforcement of immigration laws. That means more people targeted for deportation. Now, any undocumented immigrant who's been charged or convicted of any crime could be an enforcement priority. That could include somebody arrested for shoplifting or a minor traffic offense. So let's talk about this and more about the Trump presidency with former Seattle Congressman Jim McDermott. Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
Good to see you. Chris Vance, former state representative and former state Republican Party chair. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, Bill, how's it going?
It's good, thank you. I'd like to first ask both of you what you think of, here, let me get your, you have a little volume button there so you can hear him, Congressman.
That's it.
Okay. Chris, say hi to the congressman so he can hear you.
Congressman, how are you, sir?
How are you, Chris?
Problem solved.
Good.
Welcome. Okay, so here's my first question. I just mentioned the tightening of immigration policy. Congressman McDermott, what do you think of Trump making more people a priority for deportation? He says, or a DHS official says, don't panic. This is not mass deportations, but it's certainly expanding the pool of people who could be sent away.
I don't think anybody's going to trust this president until they actually see what begins to happen, because what he did with that initial ban was throw everything up in the air and make everybody worried. And so now nobody trusts him at all. He's going to have a tough job winning back the confidence of the people.
Chris Vance, your reaction to increased pool of deportation targets?
Well, it's exactly what Trump said he was going to do during the campaign. Nobody should be surprised by this. He said he was going to deport everybody who was eligible for deportation, everybody who's undocumented, beginning with convicted felons and people like that, but then eventually deporting everybody who under the law should be deported. The big thing I think for Republicans is a lot of Republicans were hoping that the presidency would change Donald Trump, or maybe he didn't mean what he said. But on the core, his core issues like protectionism regarding trade and on immigration, he meant what he said, and he's going to do what he said.
Do you think that this tightening of immigration policy affects Seattle's stance as a sanctuary city, one way or the other, Jim McDermott?
Well, I don't know about the sanctuary city. It affects us because the question here is, do we want people to come in from the outside to bring knowledge and technical ability or back labor into this country or not? And we have not resolved that. We need an immigration reform bill to really clarify this issue. Otherwise, this is going to be one kind of patchwork mess all across the country.
Chris Vance, do you think is there any question, assuming the Trump administration is dotting I's and crossing T's, is there any legal question as to whether the president gets to enforce immigration policy in the way we're talking about today?
Well, there's two parts to this. Yes, they can enforce the law, but immigration rights groups and immigrants themselves will, of course, resist. They will lawyer up. They will fight this step by step. And if the Trump administration actually tries to deport all or part of the 11 to 12 million people who are here undocumented, it is just going to jam up our courts, jam up the system. The congressman's right. I mean, in 2013, the United States Senate passed an excellent bill on immigration reform that 14 intelligent, reasonable Republicans voted for. We need comprehensive immigration reform. If Congress would pass an immigration reform law, then they could take away the president's ability to do these deportations.
You're talking about the Republican Congress we have right now?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, and I think the vast majority of Republicans actually supported the basic building blocks of policy that were in that bill. John Boehner knew it needed to pass. He just couldn't get it past some of the Tea Party members of his caucus on this and many other issues. Republicans need to show some courage and do their job and pass bills that will rein in the Trump administration.
I think really Chris has made a very important point. John Boehner knew, and John Boehner was
the former House Republican House Speaker.
He was unwilling to come across the aisle and compromise. There were plenty of votes on the Democratic side. John was afraid that if he did that, it would be the end of his speakership. And he was doomed anyway, but he should have done that. We could have had a good bill, a nice balanced bill out of the Senate. Not perfect. Some I didn't like. But it was plenty of votes between reasonable Democrats and reasonable Republicans to pass that bill.
Let's talk bigger picture about this Trump presidency, because Jim McDermott, you're teaching a University of Washington class about Trump's first 100 days, and we're a third of the way in. How would you assess this president so far? Whether agree or disagree, but you know, you also are assessing how he's doing what he's doing and what the checks and balances are.
Well, I think his personal style has made it impossible for him to get a very good start. He doesn't like to have a regular order. He wants to be the boss of everything. And to try and run it all yourself and decide it all yourself is impossible. And so he has got plenty of places that aren't filled yet. He's still trying to get a labor secretary in there. He's looking for a national security advisor until this morning, after he fired one after 15 days. I mean, this is chaos in motion, and he's got to stop that if he's going to get this country rolling internationally and domestically. But he still wants to tweet. He wants to be a 16-year-old boy that can get up in the middle of the night and say whatever he wants on his Twitter account, and that's simply not going to be acceptable for a president.
But you know, Congressman, that his fans don't mind the chaos or the tweeting or even the slow process of installing staff and cabinet members. You know, they say we want results, and you're saying, what are the odds we're still going to be talking about chaos, 6 months in or a year in?
I think we absolutely are. Yeah. We have an issue on the table which is not going to go away, and that's the whole question of the Russians' involvement in our election and what part Mr. Flynn played in all that and what part the president played in it. Were laws broken? What went on in that period before Trump became president when he was out there negotiating like he was president of the United States? Both he and Flynn were breaking what the Logan Act, it looks like, but that's going to have to come out through a legal process of a special prosecutor, and I don't know when that's going to start, but it's not going to go away.
Is that going to happen, a congressional investigation and or a special prosecutor?
I don't think there's any doubt.
Yeah.
This, you know, when Dan Rather starts talking about this, seems a lot like Watergate. It does have that. Nobody thought Watergate was going to happen. It was originally just a little burglary up at the Watergate of the Democratic headquarters. And everybody
a hotel.
Yeah, it was nothing. But ultimately, as it was brought out and dragged out, it brought out all kinds of stuff that nobody. And they have NSA stuff. Communications between Mr. Trump and the Russians and Flynn and the Russians, and you can't deny that kind of stuff. So it's ultimately going to have to come to some kind of a process that resolves whether it was legal or not.
Chris Vance, do you see your fellow Republicans in Washington, D.C. actually investigating this president over Russia connections?
Well, that's going to be a huge issue, isn't it? I mean, there is and has been and probably will be for some time a war going on for the soul of the Republican Party. There are a lot of Republicans, people like Jeff Sessions, who like Donald Trump and share his kind of protectionist, nativist, isolationist policies. There's other Republicans who absolutely oppose that and are starting to speak up, led by John McCain. And thank God for John McCain right now. I haven't always agreed with him on everything, but John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Ben Sasse and to some extent Marco Rubio and Jeff Flake. But then there's a ton of other Republicans, I think most Republicans, who just are hating this and they don't know what to do about it. They don't want to anger their own base. They don't want to get annihilated by talk radio, but they don't agree with where the Trump administration is going. They're troubled by the Russian connection. What happens within the Republican Party over the next 6 months to a year is going to be determinative on whether or not Congress does its constitutional job, which is to hold the executive branch accountable.
The person who was just talking is Chris Vance, former state representative, state Republican Party chair. The person who was nodding his head during all of that is former Seattle Congress member Jim McDermott, Democrat. Do you think, first, Chris, does it matter what Republicans in Washington state do or say?
It matters what, first of all, democracy ultimately works. Voters get what they want. If the Republican base will turn on Trump and start demanding that Republican members of Congress hold him accountable, that'll happen. But in the short term, our four Republican members of Congress matter. Two of them, really, I mean, I love Dan Newhouse and I love Jamie Herrera Butler, but Dave Reichert is now a senior member of the Ways and Means Committee, the chairman of the Trade Subcommittee on Ways and Means. He ought to be fighting the Trump administration on, he should not have accepted the death of TPP, for example. And most important is Kathy McMorris Rodgers, the number four person in the Republican leadership. She sits at the table when Paul Ryan and his lieutenants, of which she is one, make decisions of what's going to happen in the House. So at least two of our four Republican members of Congress are very important, and that's why people need to put pressure on them to put pressure on Trump.
Congressman McDermott, former congressman, so let's say Kathy McMorris Rodgers or Dave Reichert, a Washington State member of Congress, Republican, comes to you and says, I'm concerned too, but what's the strategic thing to do here? Been in Congress for more than a quarter century. What's your advice?
I think that the answer I would give them is you might as well get it out there as quick as possible because it's not going to go away. The issues are too important. I think Chris has already pointed them out, and I couldn't agree with him on more than there was a blog by Bob Reich where he talked with a former
labor secretary.
Yes, former labor secretary and now a teacher down at Berkeley. And he talked to a former member of Congress, a Republican, who said there are all kinds of people in the caucus talking about Trump as being Looney Tunes. And Reich said, well, why don't they say that publicly? He said, because they're afraid. Well, why don't they go out as a group if they're afraid individually? And he said, well, because Ryan and McConnell don't want to rock the boat. They want to get their political agenda through before this hits and breaks and explodes. And I think there's some truth to that. Ryan has been waiting forever to make his changes in healthcare, and they're interested in getting all these changes through. But they are ultimately going to have to deal with what the president and Mr. Flynn were doing, and it is going to keep festering. And now you're seeing the Russians involving themselves in the French election, and you're seeing all over the world, and people are just going to keep talking about it, and they're never going to get to the soul of the Republican Party, as Chris is saying. They have to decide this. The Democrats can't do it.
I want to talk more about Russia in a moment. I'm talking with former Seattle Congressman Jim McDermott, former State Republican Party Chair Chris Vance. By the way, last week we talked with a panel of three Donald Trump voters and enthusiastic supporters, and we have standing invitations out to the chair of the Republican Party now, Susan Hutchison, and Congressman Dave Reichert. And more so, we'll continue to look at this from different sides. We were just talking about Russia, and I want to ask both of you, what is the threat? Because I'm old enough, I'm 51, I remember when the threat to, when I was a kid from Russia was nuclear warheads pointed at me. Got it. Now, what, you know, it's not nuclear annihilation. At least I don't hear that being the talk. I realize it's bad for another country to interfere with our elections, obviously. But what is the threat from a cozier relationship between Putin and Trump? What am I supposed to be worried about?
When I was growing up, and I'm 55 years old, the threat was what you just said, and it came because of expansionist, imperialistic Russian communism. This is, I mean, to a large extent, why I became a Republican, because people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were willing to stand up to the Soviet Empire. It's now become, instead of a left-wing communist threat, Russia has metastasized into a right-wing fascist dictatorship. Its foreign policy goals remain the same. Russia has always, from Peter the Great all the way on, has wanted to dominate its neighbors and even ultimately dominate all of Europe. Putin and the ideological people around him, especially a very scary guy named Alexander Dugin, write about creating a Eurasian empire from Lisbon to Vladivostok, dominated by Russian fascism. They seek to dominate first the countries that became free when the Soviet Empire fell, and then pretty much all of the Eurasian landmass. And that sounds crazy, but they're very open about this. My biggest fear is this, is that they will move against the Baltic states, believing that perhaps President Trump will not honor our NATO commitments. They will miscalculate, and we will find ourselves in a shooting war with the only other country in the world that has a huge nuclear stockpile. And I think that keeps me up at night worrying about it.
Jim McDermott, do you worry that the U.S. would get into a shooting war in the Baltics with Vladimir Putin?
Well, I agree with Chris. I think the potential place after the Ukraine is the Baltics, and they're so easy to move in as they did in the 40s and take over Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, that you're very likely be brought to face whether we're serious about what NATO's all about. And Ukraine was not in NATO. Therefore, we didn't have the commitment. But I've been in Poland, and the Poles are scared to death that we're going to collapse and not defend Eastern Europe, that the countries like, you can already see Hungary is moving in a direction that's not very, it's not what we want nor what we hope for, and they're getting closer to Putin. And so when you see that happening in Eastern Europe, you realize that the easy one would be to knock off the Baltics as a starter, just to see, are the Americans made out of anything, or are they just talk? And that's going to be a real interesting question for us to face.
I mentioned the Trump voters we've had on and will continue to have on. I was just seeing something new in the New York Times today about, I think the headline was something like, are liberals helping Donald Trump? And the idea was, is there a liberal hyperventilation about everything Donald Trump is, says, tweets, represents, that just pushes his supporters more into his camp? I'll start with the non-liberal, anti-Trump Republican Chris Vance.
Well, yes, they are, but there's really nothing you can do about it. I mean, again, my side of the island, and look, I have never changed my political beliefs. I'm a Reagan Republican, which is why I don't support Donald Trump. I mean, I support free trade. I support NATO. Ronald Reagan passed the biggest amnesty program for, quote, illegal immigrants anyone ever did. I'm a Reaganite, and there's a huge conflict on the Republican side. And unfortunately, when moderate-ish Republicans see people protesting in the streets, they just instinctively don't like that. And it just makes them want to rally to their team. But that's just sort of unfortunate, because there's no way you can ask people to not protest and speak out. But unfortunately, one of the byproducts is it helps to firm up the other side, which is why the only way this has got to happen is Republicans have got to talk to Republicans and get them to come to their senses. And I'm trying.
Oh, so liberals, protest if you want to, but you're not the real game here. This is up to the Republicans.
You know, Bill, all of us, whether we're liberal or conservative or whatever label you want to put on us, want America to succeed. We may disagree in how we think it will succeed or in the direction it ought to go to succeed, but we want it to succeed. And part of this protesting in the street is not so much protesting Trump. It's protesting on the issue of whether or not people are entitled to have health security in the form of insurance. And the Republican Party has taken that on ever since Obama did it and voted 66 times to take it out. And so a lot of this has really nothing to do, these meetings, these town meetings that are going so badly for members are about Obamacare, which really isn't about Trump. It's about the attitude of whether or not people should be secure enough to feel that if they get sick, they're going to get taken care of and can pay for it without going into bankruptcy. That's the fundamental issue here. So it's easy to think, well, this is all protests about Trump. No, it isn't. Trump is doing exactly what he said he was going to do. The Republicans elected a guy who said they would do what they've been talking about ever since Obama put it in. So he's kind of a fall guy in a way. Really, the issue is, what are we going to do for the American people? What makes America strong?
Former Congressman Jim McDermott and former State Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, what's your final word to listeners? What do you want to leave us with?
Pay attention, stay active, speak out, and to my fellow Republicans, you know, stop instinctively supporting the head of the party just because he's the head of the party. He doesn't agree with Republican positions on traditional issues. And for one thing that may that may break his hold on the Republican Party is when he submits a budget proposal that raises the debt by $5 trillion because he wants to massively cut taxes without reforming entitlements. Maybe that will be the point where Republicans realize this guy's not a conservative. I'm hoping.
Chris Vance, former state representative and more. Good to talk with you again, Republican Chris Vance. Thank you.
You bet.
And former Seattle Congressman Jim McDermott, when does that budget come down?
Well, he should be getting a budget proposal ready within a month or so.
Uh-huh.
I don't know where they are in that process. We've heard absolutely nothing except sort of rumors. And Chris is right. I find myself thinking Chris ain't such a bad guy.
A Republican, huh?
Well, he's
about
got
that.
He's got it analyzed. The question is not of the analysis of the problem. It's what direction you're going to solve it. And I don't think Trump is ready to take on this battle because he doesn't understand enough of it.
Former Seattle Congressman Jim McDermott is now teaching a class at the University of Washington about the first 100 days of this presidency. So we're only a third in. Can we talk again soon?
I'll be here.
Thanks. I'll be here, too. Thank you for tuning in to KOW's The Record. We're live tweeting at KOW, so let us know what you think. Shipwrecks along the Northwest coast number in the thousands. A handful of them have become the obsession of shipwreck buffs. KOW's Tom Bonsi reports from the mouth of Willapa Bay in Southwest Washington.
Just the name was enough to pique my curiosity, the Wandering Wreck of Washaway Beach. So that's how come I trotted about 20 minutes down the aptly named eroding beach to lay eyes on this really long remnant of what must have once been a great wooden ship.
The beams are so enormous in that wreck. To me, that's almost, you know, how that can float on the water. There are beams that are, what, 18 inches square?
Yeah. Marianne Pence stopped for a look herself.
And then all those handmade spikes and, I guess, all the hardware. It's just, I mean, that had to weigh a ton.
It appears to be a coastal freighter, according to the Westport Maritime Museum, where Pence and her husband volunteer. Jeff Pence says the wreck emerged from the sand in 2009 and has since floated away and reappeared multiple times in the Tokeland, Washington vicinity.
I mean, you've got over 100 feet of a double-hulled, apparently sailing ship from probably at least 100 years ago. At this point, unidentified.
Pence showed pictures of this wreck and another unidentified wooden ship hulk to a recent meeting of Northwest shipwreck hunters and maritime history nuts in Astoria. The group has multiple mysteries to chew on. Arguably, the greatest is, where is the Tonquin? Scuba diver Tom Beasley of Vancouver, Canada, has been involved in the search for her since 1982.
The Tonquin is one of the holy grails of undiscovered shipwrecks in the Pacific Northwest. For me, the Tonquin is the top of that list.
The merchant ship was owned by New York millionaire John Jacob Astor. In 1811, the Tonquin carried the fur traders who set up Fort Astoria, the first permanent American settlement on the Pacific coast. The Tonquin then sailed on to Vancouver Island, where the captain insulted a native chief. That set off a battle in which most of the crew was killed. A survivor retreated to the ship's powder magazine and blew everything up to avoid capture. Beasley says this likely happened near present-day Tofino or in a bay northwest of Port Hardy, British Columbia.
There's a lot more searching that needs to be done, and there are dynamic bodies of water. In the Tofino area, the prime location is probably an area where there's dynamic sand, so it could be, if the wreck is there, it could be covered one day and uncovered 2 years later.
Archaeologist Scott Williams of Olympia, Washington, has a different holy grail, to find a Spanish galleon lost in 1693. This is known as the Beeswax Wreck, after candle wax blocks washed ashore long ago along the northern Oregon coast. Porcelain shards with distinctive patterns have also been found in the area.
You know, we always make it real clear we're not treasure hunters. If I find the wreck tomorrow and it's got cannons and coins, we don't get any of that. It belongs to the state of Oregon.
The presumption of public ownership is the same in Washington State and British Columbia waters, too. Williams is the principal investigator on a search team called the Beeswax Wreck Project. When the ocean calms this summer, the team plans to deploy a magnetometer offshore near Manzanita to look for telltale magnetic anomalies underwater. The same technique is slated to be used on a different underwater search this summer. It's so secret, it was discussed at the Astoria Shipwreck Conference only under a code name. What we know is that an unnamed historian is honing in on a small sidewheeler, notable for offering the first scheduled steamboat service on Puget Sound. The ship sank somewhere in the South Puget Sound during territorial days. I'm Tom Bonsi in Astoria, Oregon.
And this is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. This morning, at a mosque in North Seattle, Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray gave his State of the City address and, among other things, said he wants to sue President Donald Trump. KUOW's Paige Browning is covering that story. Hiya, Paige.
Hey, Bill.
So in this speech, the mayor said if the Trump administration doesn't honor the city's request for background information on executive orders restricting immigration, then the mayor is going to sue the president. And what exactly is the background information that Murray wants?
Yeah, well, so Murray's office has filed a series of public record requests today, including with the Department of Homeland Security, asking those departments, how are you defining sanctuary cities, which Seattle is one?
Mm-hmm.
They're also asking, in those sanctuary cities, what actions, enforcement actions, might the government take against those cities like Seattle? They're also asking for detailed information about what changes the Trump administration might make to immigration policies, specifically the DACA or Dreamer program, deferred action for childhood arrivals, which may have implications for Seattle if that's changed.
Okay, so he wants information, and he wants it how fast?
He says he wants that information in 20 days or there will be a lawsuit filed.
Okay. On another topic, Paige, Mayor Murray chose this mosque, the Idris Mosque in North Seattle, to give his State of the City address, which, of course, usually happens at City Hall. What did he say about why he gave his address at this mosque?
Yeah, it was pretty clear that the choice of venue was a reaction to what's going on at the federal level regarding immigration and travel bans to seven predominantly Muslim countries. He said, quote, as federal government action serves to stigmatize the Muslim community, we are taking the unprecedented action of holding the meeting at the Idris Mosque. It's the oldest traditionally built mosque west of the Mississippi. They talked about that and the history of the mosque's importance in the Northwest and Seattle, and talked about how Seattle has seen discrimination in its past, and he wants to move beyond that. And this was a show of solidarity with the Muslim community.
Besides immigration and diversity, Paige, he talked about homelessness, the crisis that he declared. And what did the mayor say about homelessness in Seattle?
Yeah, this was interesting. It's been now 15 months since Mayor Murray declared a state of emergency on homelessness. There are still 3,000 people living homeless in Seattle. He said, basically, it's time that Seattle does more. So one thing that he announced today is he wants to double the amount the city spends on homelessness. Where's that money going to come from? A property tax increase for commercial and residential properties. The details are not released yet, but he said that what he thinks it will look like is an increase of $13 a month for the average homeowner. We'll see those details in the next couple weeks.
And finally, KUOW's Paige Browning, Mayor Ed Murray announced plans for not a property tax this time, but a soda tax, 2 cents per ounce. What's he want to use that
That's
money
right.
for?
Right. Coming after our pop.
Right.
He wants this soda tax to help pay for the first year of college for Seattle students. He's calling it this 13th year program to help pay for students in Seattle to get into their first year of college. He thinks that a soda tax will bring in something like $16 million annually to help pay for that program.
KUOW's Paige Browning talking about a possible City of Seattle lawsuit against this president and a possible property tax to fund homelessness services and a soda tax as well. All issues that we're going to keep following. Paige Browning covers City Hall for KUOW. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I imagine I'm going to be interviewing Mayor Murray about all of these topics. What would you like me to ask him? We're live tweeting the show, so let me know at KUOW. KUOW's The Record continues. I'm Bill Radke. Last week, we introduced you to three non-traditional Trump voters, and we had a conversation, and nobody yelled. Well, maybe listeners, some of them might have yelled. I don't know. Nobody on the radio yelled, which got the attention of a listener named Heather, who writes to us, "That was a hard segment to listen to, but I really, all caps, really appreciate your show profiling those voters, even though I don't personally agree with them. The voter who said that people from Mexico don't want to learn English was a throw-your-phone moment for me. Thank you for helping progressive liberals like myself figure out what on earth are they thinking about people who support Trump, and I applaud those voters' courage to come on your show." Thank you for writing, Heather. That's what our show's about. We want to hear from you no matter what you believe, and we want to exchange ideas. So please send us your questions, your comments, your complaints. We're listening on Twitter at KUOW, KUOW Public Radio on Facebook, or you can email record@KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning in today. You know, you have more options than you used to, say, a decade ago. You can rent out your house on Airbnb. You can stay in a stranger's house. You can earn a little money driving for Uber. You can call up a ride on your phone. Is all of this good? Who are the losers and the winners in our so-called sharing economy? Let's ask the author of a new book called The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. Brad Stone, welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
What do Uber and Airbnb have in common?
Well, first of all, they start at the same time in the same place, the city of San Francisco, right around 2009. So the book is really the story of their rise and growth during the Obama administration. They're both kind of classified as sharing economy companies, although it's not, you know, really true. There's a lots of people that are making their homes available on Airbnb who aren't living there. There are many, you know, drivers that are basically modern day cabbies. They're not really sharing their seats.
It's not like everybody's saying, "I have a home. I'd love to meet people from China."
I want somebody on my couch.
Yeah.
I call these trust economy companies because what they do is they allow us to do the things that our mothers told us never to do, right? To go into a stranger's home or to walk into a stranger's car, and then make us feel comfortable with the transaction with the stranger.
Why are they killer companies, as you've called them?
Yeah, they've been, in, you know, these and some others that I chronicle in the book have been enormously disruptive. And so Uber, Lyft, and its ilk have turned the taxi market in most cities around the world upside down. They've crushed the value of medallions.
Those are the taxi licenses,
right?
Basically.
They've hurt the livelihood of taxi fleet owners and, in some cases, independent taxi drivers. And Airbnb has kind of warped the gravity of the hotel industry. And you see the mergers between hotel companies and lots of big travel companies kind of struggling to address the threat that is posed by Airbnb.
The conventional wisdom is these companies are good for consumers, bad for the old, inefficient, entrenched interests. Is that right?
Well, look, I mean, I'm a user of both companies. I'm a happy user. I think that Uber has certainly changed transportation and Lyft in cities for the better. Like the idea that, you know, when we go out at night, we're not either driving when we shouldn't be or waiting outside of a bar trying to hail a cab. Like, you can't argue with that. The fact that Uber and Lyft and other companies have brought transportation options into cities, into parts of cities like the south side of Chicago, for example, or the Bronx, where, you know, taxis just wouldn't go. And then Airbnb, you know, tourists have been clustered in places and cities. Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco or South Street Seaport or Times Square in New York. And they've been sort of fed artificial experiences. And so, again, Airbnb, like Uber, is bringing new options and new price points into a market. So I think they have been good for people.
That's interesting because I guess I'm a skeptical person. And when I hear people talking killer companies, game changer, I think 20 years ago, I could hail a cab, I could order something through the mail, I could talk to somebody on the other side of the world. It just took a little longer, but come on. Is this really life of a different kind?
I mean, it's a fair point. I do think that if you live in certain parts of the world that were badly served, not only by taxis, but by public transportation, then these things are game changers. You know, if you couldn't afford a nice hotel and you were going to the Motel 6 and now Airbnb, or let's say you just have a family, you know, and you've got a bunch of kids, and instead of paying to get extra hotel rooms, you know, Airbnb now offers you an option with a separate room and a kitchen, you know, that I think that for some people, it is life-changing. Now, we're going to talk about the negative externalities,
yes,
the drawbacks, because these stories aren't all good.
Yeah, who loses in the sharing, on-demand, app economy? I don't know what you call it. What's your favorite term?
I mean, I sort of play around with this idea of the trust economy. But look, the upstarts.
I'm going
to go with the title of my book.
What's the downside of the upstarts?
Well, let's start with Airbnb. I live in a nice, quiet residential neighborhood in South San Francisco. I wouldn't love it if my neighbor moves out and then puts his home on Airbnb and suddenly at 2 a.m. in the morning that there are European tourists outside trying to get in. Particularly, I wouldn't like that if I lived in an apartment building. And in fact, you know, there are laws in a lot of major cities that limit or really don't even make it legal to do these things.
You know, Seattle and Airbnb are fighting, right?
Of course. It's Airbnb now in almost every city now has new, fresh regulatory challenges. And it's because cities are waking up to the drawbacks. It turns out we cluster our tourists in certain neighborhoods for a reason. Mm. They can be disruptive to residential neighborhoods, and they can have negative impacts on the rental and the housing market. If people are leaving their homes and instead of putting them on the market, they're just going to say, hey, I'm going to turn this into a revenue opportunity and just Airbnb it.
Because I'm so sharing.
Yeah, that's one.
I'm such a sharer.
Right. Then that's one piece of property that is no longer available, and you start to warp the supply of housing. And so that I think that's why it's a major drawback. We really don't have a firm grasp on the true economic impact of Airbnb on the housing supply, and it's one reason why all cities are now grappling with putting limits on the company.
Some more downsides. In your last book, you wrote about how Amazon avoided state sales taxes. How are these killer companies, these disruptors, how are they skirting the rules?
Well, I mean, so we talked about Airbnb. You know, in some places like New York, it was just illegal. You couldn't do it. And instead, they grew quietly and they tried to muster a big enough community to go and change the law. And actually, Airbnb hasn't quite been successful in that particular instance.
But there's a lot of off-the-books bookings, right?
There still is. I mean, enforcement is a huge challenge.
Yeah.
Uber is interesting because it has the reputation as more of the law breaker. There was more ambiguity in the taxi laws around Uber. You were supposed to either hail a yellow cab or prearrange a limo or a black car. And Uber and Lyft came into the market with this thing called a kind of digital hail, not really a prearrangement, not really waving your hand on the street. And so in that regard, they were kind of bending the rules. And then they introduced this thing called ride sharing, which is you don't need a professional taxi license. You could just start driving your own car as long as it's not a beater from the 70s, you know, and pick anybody up. And of course, Seattle and a lot of other cities went through this belabored process of trying to figure out should that be legal. In a lot of cases, these companies just kind of plowed ahead and came into cities with guns blazing. You know, particularly in places like Europe and South America, they kind of paid the price. And in North America, they were sort of able to bend city governments to their will in large part, and you can't dismiss this, because people loved the services and used them and were willing to kind of come out in support for them and to make them legal.
Let's talk about sexist and racist bias. Uber's CEO has ordered an investigation after a former employee alleged sexual harassment and gender bias during her time at the company. Airbnb owners have been accused of not renting to racial minorities. I want to know, is bias more of a problem in the so-called sharing trust economy?
Yeah, there's a real irony in that these companies, you know, full of Silicon Valley-style idealism, thought of themselves as eradicating the biases of the past
and so utopian
opportunity. Yeah, so utopian. You know, Airbnb, prided itself on the use of photographs, the lavish use of photographs on the service to establish trust between guests and hosts. And then it turned out that a Harvard researcher kind of ran the numbers and found that African Americans were having a much harder time on the service, you know, than white people. And is that Airbnb's fault, or did they become a kind of window for a pernicious form of American racism? And what can they do to eradicate it? And they certainly, you know, addressed it head on and are talking about doing what they can do with the design of the service to kind of minimize it.
Well, that sounds like a PR statement, though. Are they addressing it head on? Can they solve
and
the
they
problem
do it,
or not?
And is it Airbnb's problem, or is it racism that's out there and they become a venue for it? The Uber situation is a little different, right? Because this is a company that has been accused in the past of being a kind of bro club, having a frat boy culture. They had some instances with some very poorly thought out promotions in France and other parts of the world. And then into all of its brand problems, some of related to the current president, president and the CEO's presence on his advisory board, you know, comes this statement from
an engineer. He was counseling President Trump, and he got a boycott for it.
That's right, and he had to leave the council. And then more recently, you know, we have a former Uber engineer alleging sexual harassment and saying the company did nothing when she raised it to HR. You know, clearly just an abhorrent experience she had to endure. The company has hired Eric Holder, the former attorney general, ironically the same person that Airbnb hired to lead its investigation of racism on the platform. So Eric Holder getting a lot of work these days. And
there's sexual harassment in lots of places, but, you know, there is the bro culture.
I would say it's a Silicon Valley problem. Uh-huh. You know, women are underrepresented, particularly in engineering teams. And look, I mean, it's probably present in a lot of industries. I don't think Uber has a monopoly on boorish behavior in the workplace. The question is, was it a culture that was endemic to this kind of behavior? We'll see. And I think we need to measure Uber, not on these anecdotes, which are powerful, but on the data that we'll get about diversity at the company and how much progress it makes towards its own goals.
So with all that in mind, Brad, this is Brad Stone, the author of The Upstarts, Uber, Airbnb, other killer companies we're talking about. Then with all that in mind, do you think that the frictionlessness can be a bad thing? Because sometimes friction is good. Friction is protection. And without friction, we could be awful to each other. Can we have the disruptors without the downsides?
It's interesting. It's a good, interesting point. There's a chapter in my book that I call The Non-Starters, which I catalog all the companies that got into these two businesses before Uber and Airbnb, and there were actually a number of them. And nobody will
remember. They had the same good ideas.
Yeah, same good ideas, but they failed because they were too idealistic or they weren't ruthless enough. They tried to play by the rules. So sad.
So sad.
But, you know, there were companies that tried to work with yellow cabs. Do the app thing with yellow cabs seems like a great idea. But it turns out that, you know, on a Friday night when yellow cabs are scarce, there weren't cars available on the app. And if you couldn't raise prices in times of high demand, then you couldn't get more drivers out. Or you might hail a cab on one of these services and they see someone outside a hotel going to the airport and they just veer over to the side of the road and pick that guy up. Mm. And so I do think that playing by the rules, moving more slowly, being too idealistic in these markets was a negative. And so, you know, these are the companies that kind of emerged from this last phase of Silicon Valley. And I think that it took a certain kind of CEO, a charismatic storyteller, but an aggressor, a pugnacious guy like Travis Kalanick of Uber to really make a mark in these industries. And then the side impact, the side effect is all the kind of controversy that they have left in their wake.
Those people who had the same great idea, but their timing was off or they were too nice. How are they sleeping at night?
Yeah.
They're not billionaires.
No, I think there's some wistfulness there and some regret.
Wistful.
Yeah. And more than one of them, and I tell their stories in the book, was basically along the lines of, you know, please don't ruin my career. Because, you know, I think they had the tiger by the tail and they let it go. And that's probably tough to live with, particularly when you look and you see Uber, a $70 billion company in 8 years. And we'll see if it goes up from there or down. But there was an enormous untapped opportunity that a lot of people saw. And these are the companies that emerge.
You say we'll see whether Uber goes up or down. Are these companies more vulnerable than we're realizing? Because it's not like they have massive they don't have the cloud or something, but, you know, they get in trouble, they get boycotted. Can these companies come and go faster than we think?
Right. In our geeky Silicon Valley parlance, we call this the competitive moat. Right?
Oh, I've never heard that word.
How deep is the moat? And I think you're right. For Uber, it's pretty shallow. Like the idea that Lyft and some other companies have been able to kind of hang out, you know, and compete and gain market share in some cities. It suggests that, like, there's less of a, you know, a network effect than Uber might have wanted to believe. You know, and there's also this giant question mark hanging in the future of Uber, which is driverless cars. And I don't know, Bill, if you're a believer there, but like this idea that one day cars will drive themselves, and you've got Google and Tesla and Ford and GM trying to pioneer that. And if Uber can't lead in that market, you know, maybe the company doesn't last that long, because these theoretically would be cheaper rides and you wouldn't need a driver. And then it's unclear what Uber has, you know, what its advantage is.
Right.
I think Airbnb is in a little bit of a stronger position because it is a global company. It doesn't have much in the way of competitors.
We use VRBO all the time. How come Airbnb kills VRBO? I have no idea.
I think Airbnb understood that there was a VRBO opportunity in cities.
That's vacation rental by owner.
Yeah. Right. And it was kind of clustered in vacation spots.
Okay.
And Airbnb's strength is in major cities. Oh. But look, like they're no longer taking anyone by surprise. And these large, big, diversified travel companies, you know, like the Pricelines and the Expedias now are developing their own rival services. And so Airbnb's opportunity is to kind of expand from home sharing into other services for tourists. And that's their big challenge.
Aha, you mentioned Expedia, which is not a Silicon Valley company. It is a Eastside coming to Seattle company. Where does Seattle stand in all of this? Silicon Valley's right in your book subtitle, but what about Seattle?
Every time I come to Seattle, I am amazed at the impact that Amazon is having on your city. You know, it has made this enormous bet on an urban campus. It appears to be growing at just an unimaginable velocity. I think since my book came out in 2013 on Amazon, the market cap of the company is up by 3x.
You didn't bring the company down?
Even though Jeff Bezos' wife
gave you one star?
That's right. It's an amazing company that customers love. I'm a huge Amazon customer. I have the Amazon Echo. My kids talk to a computer now. So I'm just wildly impressed by Amazon. And it seems to me that Amazon is beginning to kind of change the fabric of the city in mostly good ways. There's an enormous amount of entrepreneurial energy here that I didn't notice 10 years ago, in large part because of Amazon.
The author is Brad Stone. The book is The Upstarts. We've talked a lot about Uber and Airbnb. There are other disruptor companies. You can use your app to get your laundry done, to get, obviously, groceries delivered. What's coming down the pike?
Look, if I knew what those were, I might not be a journalist.
You can't tell me anything that's coming up. It's that unpredictable.
Well, I mean, I think the Echo is interesting, this idea of talking to our computers. And I think, you know, we're going to see lots of interesting applications and tools on those kinds of platforms. And then, you know, driverless cars, artificial intelligence, of course, virtual reality. I don't know if you're a believer, Bill, but I love the idea that one day when we're in an old folks home and can't travel, we could still, you know, put a pair of these goggles on and be transported. So I do think it will have a pretty big impact.
Yeah, I think it probably will. I like old-fashioned reality more than a lot of people. So there's a big market.
Bill, you're dating yourself.
Yes, indeed. Reality escaping is a big thing, as we know. Coming to the end now, Brad Stone, author of The Upstarts. Most of this, our listeners can't do anything about, but I still like to know how we should feel about it. You know, because like I said earlier, I'm kind of skeptical. When we seem to worship a technology, I start to wonder what the pros and cons are. And you've immersed yourself in this for years. So I just wonder, how are we feeling?
I would say talk to your Uber driver, talk to your Lyft driver, you know,
yeah.
And I always do. And there are certainly some complaints about their income and how fares have gone down over the past few years. But by and large, you know, they love the flexibility. It's created an option for them between jobs or instead of a job or during school. Go to places in Seattle or in other cities that were never served well by the taxi market. The idea now that not only can they hail a ride, but also if unemployment is high, that there's a source of income, a source of work.
Of course, you're talking to the people who are still Uber drivers. This is not a scientific sample.
That's true. That's true. And look, it's not purely a rosy situation. And you get drivers that are kind of disgusted by it. I think in some ways it's a poor full-time job, but it's a very good part-time job. I'm of the opinion that if these companies can follow through on their promises, and in Uber's case, it's to reduce traffic, and let's be frank, they're nowhere near accomplishing that goal. But if in five,
how would Uber reduce traffic?
Well, in two ways. One, there are services like Uber Pool or Lyft Line that is making it easy to carpool.
Okay.
And number two, with this perhaps fanciful idea of driverless cars coming down the pike, you know, that you don't have to own cars anymore, but that you just get them when you need them, it has all sorts of momentous potential impact for like parking lots and how we design our cities, or even garages and how we design our homes. So that may be far out in the future. And Bill, I could tell you're skeptical.
Well, I would think that here's a company that drives you in cars. So maybe I'm more likely to make that car trip since it's become so much easier.
I don't know. Maybe stay away from the subway or buses.
Maybe.
So I think they could end up, and they might be right now, making traffic worse. But if they can accomplish some of their idealistic goals over the next couple of years, and with Airbnb, it's kind of to restore some authenticity to travel, then I think there won't be any ambiguity. But I think you're right to ask the question, and we should sort of demand results from these companies, because we did kind of give them a pass when they were in the early years when they were illegal. And, you know, I think we need to watch them closely.
How would we do that? How would we demand results? How would we watch closely? What can a listener do to make this turn out well instead of badly?
I mean, we vote with our dollars, right? And I think we need this dialogue in public forums and cities. You know, if the data shows that Uber is making traffic worse or that Airbnb is driving up home prices, then we need to take a fresh approach to regulating them. And for consumers, it's spending our dollars with them.
Okay, you're not giving tech a free pass there.
I try not to. I mean, I think, you know, in my Amazon book and in this book as well, these aren't hagiographic portraits of these companies. You know, I try to tell their stories and then grapple with, you know, some of their impact, some of the disruptive effects that they're having, particularly on small businesses.
I've really enjoyed this conversation, Brad. Thanks a lot for coming back in.
Thank you, Bill.
Brad Stone wrote about Amazon before, and his new book is called The Upstarts: How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. And you can hear more from Brad tonight if you're in Seattle, because he's going to be at Town Hall with GeekWire's Todd Bishop, another regular on KUOW's The Record. That's tonight at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke.
-46 degrees and cloudy in Seattle, with a chance of rain in the forecast for the rest of the day, overnight, and tomorrow. It's a minute past 1 o'clock. The news is next.